a list of questions. Do you think they're more often asked of people who live alone or people who live with others? Why don't you get a cat? Won't you be lonely? Got a good security system? In Australia, one in four households have just one person in them, and they often have to defend that situation in the face of misunderstanding or stigma. But they also might well be able to teach non-singletons a bit about healthy social connections. Dr. Michelle Lim is a registered clinical psychologist and chief scientific advisor for a network called Ending Loneliness Together. Michelle, welcome back to Life Matters.
Thanks for having me, Hilary.
Now, the data from the Australian Institute of Family Studies is that one in four Australian households has only one person in it. How well do we recognise that reality in Australia when it comes to social policy, but also our attitudes?
Look, I think increasingly, especially in Australia and other parts of the world, living alone is becoming the norm. And the way we've kind of built our cities haven't actually really been very nurturing to our social relationships for some time. And this increase in living alone really also signals to us that we really have to kind of think about how people who live alone actually develop new relationships and maintain the ones they already have. And I think some of the questions that you have and you alerted to before, they're very interesting because I think a lot of these misconceptions about people who live alone perhaps do come from this confusion of other concepts like loneliness, which is also something that's a very much a common phenomenon, one in four as well, of Australians report problematic levels of loneliness. So I think there might be a little bit of confusion of what those two concepts are.
Well, and how well do we know how well those things are matched, people living alone and being lonely?
So we do know from research they're independent constructs. So they are somewhat related, but not in statistical terms, what we call, you know, really poorly correlated or poorly associated with each other. So for those who don't know, you know, social isolation is very much an objective construct. It's broadly defined as having fewer people around you, including living alone would be considered one. But loneliness is much more subjective feeling of social isolation. And loneliness is when you feel distress because your social needs are not being met. And you can actually be lonely in a relationship. You can be lonely in a family. You can be lonely living with other people. And the converse is true. So you can be socially isolated but not feel lonely. So I think people get confused and therefore might kind of make, you know, well-intentioned recommendations to people who live alone, thinking that perhaps they might be lonely.
Well, yes, we do seem to have this idea that the nuclear family in particular is a protective buffer against loneliness throughout the years. I guess it's going to be a long-term protection. And as you say, you know, that might ignore some of the loneliness it is possible to feel within those relationships. How much is it about personality and how much is it about people's life circumstances that dictates whether or not they'll be lonely while living alone?
Very good question, and also a very complex one. What we do know is that all of us carry a particular set of risk factors that might actually lead to loneliness. And age, for example, is one. So if you're younger or older, you might hold higher risk. But other things like your health, you know, being able to move around, financial resources, how rich the social environment that you are in at the moment, you know, all these factors kind of synergistically interact and actually lead to loneliness or not loneliness, and your access to kind of solutions or organic ones and the way you interact with people in your day-to-day life, all those things kind of add to the mix. And I think what's really apparent in research is that we are now really understanding that both loneliness and social isolation, they're very nuanced and complex, that actually painting that broad brush on people is really actually very unhelpful. For example, you know, if you're living alone, you know, just have pets, that would be fine for some people, but not actually a solution for others. So we really need to think about human beings and our needs as really diverse and complex. And what might work for me is not going to work for you.
I was reading an opinion piece by a younger writer called Deirdre Fidge, who was surprised by how much she enjoyed living alone. She'd had this fear that it would be lonely or strange. And then she realised she loved the privacy after shared housing. She got to know her neighbours. Where are people picking up those ideas that people who live alone are sad and strange that leads to that stigmatisation?
It's probably years and decades of movies, you know, social media. In fact, there's now research that says that people who do live alone, the ones that are, I would probably classify them as not disadvantaged in any way. So they're not the socially disadvantaged group, because we have obviously people who are very socially disadvantaged and living alone that need more assistance. But the people who are very mobile, who are embedded within our workplaces and the social environment, that group of people, this research actually says that they have been able to build and buffer the effects of loneliness because they've had no choice but to build that structure around them, that scaffolding, and in fact may even put more effort into their social relationships because they know that that's actually not embedded within their environment. Whereas people who are living with other people might get a little bit lazy sometimes. We're not often very good at social hygiene. We may not actually reach out to other people as much as we should, and perhaps less prepared. So I think, when we live alone, people don't kind of take those things for granted. And I think that's probably a very sensible thing for them to do.
We're speaking with Dr. Michelle Lim, who's a registered clinical psychologist, and she's the chief scientific advisor for a network called Ending Loneliness Together. And we're trying to look at sift the fact from the fiction, really, when it comes to how people who live alone are doing when it comes to loneliness and social connection and well-being. Michelle, we did a story recently on Life Matters on male friendships and how they can sometimes suffer from lack of attention, particularly later in life after people have been coupled. And it was really poignant to hear, the stories from men saying, yeah, I lost touch with my friends when I was married. That happens to a lot of people. Is there a difference between the ways men and women live alone and experience being alone?
So I'm going to speak to some data, Australian-based data, which is the HILDA data, which is a huge longitudinal study across Australia. And what we have found is that men were more socially isolated. So they were they have fewer contacts and are in contact with the degree of contact and seeing people. They're just a lot less than women. But what we found was that women were the ones that were expressing more loneliness. So despite not being socially isolated, so it does speak to there's a potential gender difference between how men and women perceive their relationships. And we know this from years of science that women have kind of different social needs. Their threshold is probably a lot higher. They need to have the one-on-one and they need to have that degree of closeness, whereas men may not desire as much, but still desire it, but just not as much as women. Again, of course, we have taken account individual differences. So, when we're kind of talking these terms, it's very broad brush, huge epidemiological studies with thousands of people in it. But there's always going to be people who have those higher social needs than others, regardless of whatever gender you're in.
So it sounds like it's about working out what needs of around social connection you have and putting in place some systems in your life if you're living alone to make sure those needs are met. What are some of those things that you can have in place, Michelle, if you want to live alone well?
Look, I think having a real strong connection with your community, and your community could be your neighborhood, but it could be kind of wider than that. So it could be a group that you really attend, that you have some shared interests with. Even though it kind of sounds very, a little bit light and trivial, I think that actually offers people a difference in the way they interact. So it's not work-based, it's something fun where they can really come together to kind of do something positive and healthy and actually, nurture a different part of them. The other thing really is to really do a consistent active reach out. I think a lot of people who might worry about feeling lonely, they often think they have to do some large gesture to kind of make friends. But actually, a lot of the networks that we build around us take take a while to build, and they're actually little things that we do. So we don't have to throw the street party, you know, for us to kind of get to know people. It's that high and by over time that you build your neighbors, and that little interaction that just goes deeper and deeper each time you interact. And some of these things can't be forced, you know, it's really organic. And saying hi to strangers, and those strangers turn into acquaintances, and those acquaintances turn into friends. And then, you know, that's the kind of process that happens over time, happens organically. But we all kind of just need to make that little bit of an effort and kind of build that.
Is there other cultures or other models around the world that we can look to here as well for different ideas of community?
Look, I think there are a lot of collective cultures that have different ways of interacting. So, you know, the circle of network and your reliance on them actually is wider. So I could think a lot of kind of collective cultures in South America, for example, even in African countries and in parts of Asia, where it's all about community in the neighborhood and the reliance. And it's interesting because there's, you know, some kind of arguments as well or hypotheses about why that's the case. And sometimes people say perhaps, you know, when you have fewer financial resources, you really have to kind of rely on wider networks beyond your family a little bit more. So that's, you know, one of the competing kind of arguments around that. But I think that's up for debate. And I think there's a lot more research within the socio-ecological research area, which I'm not as familiar with compared to the psychological ones. But I think that there's a culture that, in particular with Australia, that we do stay within a particular boundary, you know, the nuclear family or not beyond your extended family, and what kind of things we are able to say to friends and not able to say to friends. And sometimes those things can be quite inflexible. And if you do feel lonely and if you are socially isolated, it can really kind of pigeonhole and kind of isolate you further. So I think the conversation is about talking about how critical social connection is to our well-being and our, not just to us, our personal health and well-being, but to the wider community and towards society. That especially since COVID, I think people don't realize the importance of social connection, that we're starting to realize, oh, it's loneliness, it's not being socially isolated. I didn't realize those things actually make a difference to how I feel. And I hope that's a little bit of a lesson for most of us to learn, is that, you know, as we kind of progress through and recover, you know, how do we now develop and maintain relationships, and whether those sorts of things can be done and achieved in the long term. So not something that we just do for a short term, but it's really built into our routines.
Well, and speaking of building things in, Michelle Lim, what can we do as a society, as a community, to legitimise the experiences of people who live alone, both in, I guess, our attitudes, but also perhaps the way we plan and build our towns and cities?
Look, I think, the urban design researchers would really talk about walkability, you know, that we have to build cities where we do come into contact with each other, because those social opportunities then allow us to build stronger social connection, allow us to build that meaningful relationships where we feel less lonely. So I think even things like transport, I mean, it sounds like it may not make a difference, but, you know, for someone who's less mobile, for example, or who might have, you know, a physical disability, or maybe older, or maybe even, you know, a young mom who can't transport children easily, you know, that walkability and being able to walk towards a cafe and or common space or a green space, a park where you can actually just head there easily, actually will influence the level of social connection we have with other people. Because with social opportunities means that we are able to actually initiate and build those relationships, and we can do so over time. So I think we do need to do a lot more, increasing accessibility, but also building spaces that are safe for people to actually meet and come together. It also includes things like removing barriers to the way people interact with each other. So, you know, perhaps, you know, legal requirements where people can actually come together in their neighborhoods to actually build and get to know their neighbors, for example. I can think about, you know, even workplace policies about making sure that every floor in your building has a tea room or there's space and time booked in to kind of get to know your colleagues, or, you know, having lunch together is encouraged. Those sorts of little kind of actions do actually make a difference in the way we get to know other people.
It's really interesting to hear that safety and accessibility are perhaps as important as attitudinal change. Michelle Lim, thank you so much for having a chat to us today about the nuances of loneliness and aloneness in Australia today.
Thank you, Hilary, for having me.
Dr. Michelle Lim, registered clinical psychologist and chief scientific advisor for a national network called Ending Loneliness Together. This is Life Matters on Radio National.
ABCRN helps you understand the world. Find more of our stories on the ABC Listen app.